Salt Lake City's new public safety building nears completion. The Utah Attorney General's office lets two former DABC executives off the hook. And Utah State basketball player Danny Berger is released from the hospital. You're listening to the KUER News Pod for Tuesday, December 10th. I'm Brian Grimmett. Salt Lake City's new public safety building is expected to produce as much energy as it uses and bring the city's police, fire, and emergency operations departments closer together. KUER's Whitney Evans donned a hard hat and safety gear to tour the facility, which is slated for completion this June.
Construction activity is vigorous, but what's already apparent is the building will be big and it will be green. When complete, it will be the first public safety building in the nation to take on net zero status, with the help of energy efficiencies like solar panels and radiant heating in the floors. Deputy Police Chief Tim Dowd says employees will have to do their part as well. Personal items like printers, coffee makers, and refrigerators will not be allowed.
Cops and firefighters are really independent. They want to have their own stuff because it's my stuff and this is my office. That's a big cultural change.
Stout says employees have been giving up personal appliances a little at a time, so it won't come as such a shock. Another cultural shift for employees will be the ability to work more closely with other departments. Project manager Chad Jones says right now detectives work on different floors in two separate buildings.
Two different detectives will be investigating the same thing and never even know it. So they're going to be collaborating, working much more together. Police and fire also don't work together at all right now. They're on separate floors, never communicate, coordinate with each other. So they're going to be working together side by side, sharing break rooms, sharing conference rooms, coffee pots, you know, the printers, all working together.
The new public safety building was made possible with the help of a $125 million bond Salt Lake City voters approved in 2009. It's located on 300 East between 4 and 500 South, which is adjacent to the Salt Lake City Public Library. Whitney Evans, KUER News.
The Utah Attorney General's office has decided not to prosecute the former executive director of the Department of Alcoholic Beverage Control, Dennis Kellen. He resigned after an audit of the agency, but prosecutors say it doesn't look like any DABC employees received personal gain from the mismanagement. They also declined to file charges against Earl Dorius, another top staffer at the agency. Dorius resigned in March amid reports he accepted free dinners from a friend who owns 8 establishments that hold liquor licenses. Danny Berger got out of the hospital in Salt Lake last Saturday and made it to Logan in time to watch his Utah State teammates defeat Western Oregon 86-57. Berger collapsed on the basketball court during practice a week ago. An alert trainer revived him with an automatic defibrillator and spent several days recovering at Intermountain Medical Center. Berger is hoping he will play again, but is taking it day by day. 6 weeks is the earliest he can get back out on the court. Hundreds of friends and fans gathered in Milwaukee over the weekend to remember Rick Majerus. He died of heart failure last week at the age of 64. Majerus led Utah to the NCAA Finals in 1998, and he also coached at Marquette, Ball State, and St. Louis University. About a dozen former Utah players attended the service, including Keith Van Horn, Andre Miller, and Michael Doliak. SkyWest Airlines says a disruption in its computer network kept its flights throughout the country from taking off for about 2 hours yesterday. Spokesperson Marissa Snow says the system went down about 5 a.m. and came back online around 7. SkyWest is based in St. George. It serves passengers from United, Delta, U.S. Airways, American Airlines, and others. It was ranked 11th among major airlines in on-time arrivals in September. Two guys put a rope around an ATM in a convenience store in Murray yesterday and dragged it down the road. Police say they pulled it more than a mile down the road before they finally loaded it on the back of their truck and drove off. Officers are looking for a white Ford truck. An off-duty police officer put his own truck between a vehicle involved in a police chase and a jogger by the side of the road. The Mercedes AMG had been stolen from a local dealership, and Officer Jim Carajalio spotted it just in time. It crashed into his truck, but the jogger wasn't hurt. She says Carajalio's quick thinking saved her life. Officers arrested Derek Thompson on a long list of charges. And finally, a very real controversy in the West is the platform for a story of a fictional family in Nevada in Jana Richman's novel The Ordinary Truth. Betsy Burton has this review.
A deputy manager of the Nevada Water Authority, Kate Jorgensen, goes on TV to inform the people of Nevada that the city of Las Vegas intends, with her authority's approval, to lay hundreds of miles of pipeline under the Nevada and Utah aquifers. Her relatives in rural Nevada are understandably aghast. How can she possibly risk their land and their livelihoods on a project intended to foster the burgeoning population and extravagant overuse of water of that global gambling and entertainment mecca? The family cattle ranch in Nevada goes back well over a century, and water rights are at its very heart, and at their family's heart as well. But something else rests at this family's heart, Kate's mother's failure, upon the untimely death of her husband 36 years before, to give genuine love to Kate, their 10-year-old daughter, a failure compounded by Kate's subsequent problems parenting her daughter, Cassie. What does happen when a mother can't, for whatever reason, muster up the love that's a child's due? What goes on in such a mother's head? What happens to the child, to that child's children? These are questions commonly addressed from the outside, from the points of view of those affected by such failures, but only rarely from the inside, from the interior viewpoint of a woman who doesn't like motherhood. Carried down to the third generation in Richmond's novel, this is easily as intriguing as are the fraught issues of water and land that she explores, issues that divide the inhabitants and the governments of Utah and Nevada to this very day. The ordinary truth, told from the very different perspectives of three strong Western women, Kate, her daughter, and her mother, doesn't so much tell the truth as it does offer everyone's version of it, whether that truth involves love or parenthood, the land, who loves it, the water, who owns it. We live in fraught times in the West, and motherhood is seldom anything but fraught. Richmond's miraculous skill lies in her ability to capture two such disparate issues in the crucible of a novel in which characters are fully drawn, the land is sparsely beautiful and haunting as we know it to be, her love for both deeply felt.
And that is your KUER News Pod for Tuesday, December 10th. For the latest news and updates from around the state, be sure to check us out online at KUER.org. Until next time, I'm Brian Grimmett.